Welcome to Scientific American Science Talk, posted on September 24th, 2019. I'm Steve Mirsky. On this episode...
It's very common now to hear really smart people say, well, string theory, that's a, you know, that's a dead end. I just don't think that's the view of many of those experts. I say again, that, you know, ultimately, nature will be the judge.
That's physics historian Graham Farmala. Longtime listeners may recall hearing him talk about his Paul Dirac biography, The Strangest Man, and the subsequent Churchill's Bomb, about the early British efforts to develop a fission bomb. His latest book is The Universe Speaks in Numbers, about the relationship between physics and mathematics. A symposium on the subject took place recently at Princeton's Institute for Advanced Study. I caught up with Farmala after the symposium. Let me cut right to the chase, the last line of the book, which I think is a good place to start. The last line is, the universe is whispering its secrets to us in stereo. It's the in stereo that's really key there.
Well, that's right. There are two ways, I would argue, that the universe is speaking to us. First of all, the way that everyone knows about, which is the in the form of results from experiments. We talk about nature speaking to us through measurements we make, through observations. But what I think is becoming increasingly clear is that mathematics is also guiding us towards a fundamental understanding of the laws of nature. Just give one concrete example. When Einstein was working on his theory of gravity, he felt impelled by the mathematical structure drove him to the final answer. And he would tell you this. And his peer and colleague Dirac felt very strongly that mathematics was leading him to a solution. So in that sense, nature is speaking to us through mathematics.
If the math is right, it must be true. It must be real in the material world.
Yeah, well, I've got to say that it's not a perfect balance, because in the end, experiment has got to be hold the right answer. But mathematics does have this way of guiding you to the right final solution. As I said, this happened with Dirac's understanding of the electron, with Einstein's understanding of gravity. You know, that you can't just mess about with these things. There's a mathematical structure that puts you in a straitjacket, so to speak, right? And even in future generations, you have to stick pretty close to that straitjacket in trying to develop it.
Now, you wrote about Dirac in one of your previous books and about this aesthetic that he had, that it had to be beautiful.
Yep.
And the more beautiful it was, the more right it would be.
Yeah.
But is that simply an aesthetic, or is there an underlying reality to it?
Well, this is a controversial question, of course. You're absolutely right to say that for Paul Dirac, the great English theoretical physicist, he came to the conclusion that the way to do theoretical physics, to get a really good understanding of nature at the deepest level, was to be guided by beautiful mathematics. Mathematics that mathematicians regard as beautiful, because that so often found its way into our understanding of nature.
And he argued that beauty in for example, painting, would be in part culturally dependent.
Yes.
But that he said it didn't, for math, it didn't matter.
It is. That I have to say, I think that is a stretch. I'm not Dirac, but I have to say, I think it's a fair criticism to say that in his great 1939 lecture, when he said for the first time, I believe, that yes, these other types of beauty are culturally dependent, but mathematical beauty is of a different type. Right? It's something every mathematician knows about. Now, I don't think that would hold up in a philosopher's court, personally, but it is something that does have a certain resonance, if I put it that way, right, with leading theoretical physicists. Not all of them. Some people believe that you can get seduced by what appears to them beautiful mathematics and take it off on the wrong track, right? But it's certainly true that Dirac did not believe that. He believed that if you don't have an appreciation of beautiful mathematics, you should not be doing theoretical physics. He felt that strongly.
Right. There's a quote in your book where he says that.
The mathematical beauty was for him and his friend Erwin Schrödinger, one of the co-discoverers of quantum mechanics. This was almost a religion.
Yeah. So why did you feel compelled to put all this down, this it's kind of a great history of about the last 300 years of math and physics mm-hmm. and how they relate to each other. Mm-hmm. And one of the big challenges mm-hmm. is writing about math without showing us the math yeah. in most of the cases.
Yeah.
So what was your goal in the book? Why did you feel compelled to write it? And how did you address that challenge of mm-hmm. explaining math without math?
Yeah. All right. Lots of good questions there. Let me just try to put it first of all in a personal perspective, if I can give it that way. When I started out in the world of theoretical physics, this very mathematical approach was in its infancy, and I hated it. I just thought, nature can't be this complicated. This is going to go away. And I was wrong. It hasn't. And that kind of mathematics has endured. I wanted to have a better understanding of those faulty odd years of development. But much more important, I think, is that I think that there is in my opinion, too little understanding of how Einstein's successors at the frontiers of theoretical physics ply their trade, do their work. Still, the majority of people believe, if you look at most popular books on this subject, that you take your cues from experiment, you build your theories, and you know, everything is pretty well hunky-dory. That's the way you do. And that is actually, to be fair, that is true for many theoretical physicists and for most scientists. So I don't have a dispute with that. What I think is true is that in this particular epoch, so to speak, or era, perhaps is a better word, we've had really relatively few clues from experiment. We'd had the Higgs boson discovery in 2012. We had the discovery of the accelerating expansion of the universe, a terribly important discovery. But we haven't had that many really great clues. Now, what that means is that physicists, instead of picking up on these surprising clues, have gone into the rich mathematical structures of the theories that we know work well. Einstein's theory of gravity, great, great theory, and the so-called gauge theories of fundamental particles that work brilliantly. So the question is, can you develop the rich mathematics of those theories in order to advance and maybe even work towards a unified understanding of those basic forces, which is something that the string framework purports to do. What I wanted to do was to investigate the legitimacy, so to speak, of many leading people in the field, right, who are not particularly keen on speaking out, frankly, right? Their work is what they're here to do. They're not often great popularizers or enthusiastic popularizers, right? But I wanted to represent the case that these great theorists, Edward Witten, Nimr al-Kanihamed, Juan Maldacena here at the Institute and many others elsewhere, they're working in the tradition that in fact goes back to Einstein, all the way back to Maxwell and Newton, right? Now, this is absolutely not to guarantee, right, that they're on exactly the right path. I simply wanted to say that this is a defensible system that is still well worth persevering. I might say that was the conclusion I came to, but I had an inkling of that when I started the book. But I hope I've made at least a case that these people are not, frankly, wasting their time, lost in mathematics, have no idea what they're talking about. This, to me, is a borderline insulting view of very smart people who can't be bothered, frankly, right, to get involved in sort of petty, low-level discussions on these things.
Yeah, that's the big issue. I mean, for us lay people, we hear about complaints that all the stuff with string theory is not testable, so it's not really physics. It's more like mathematical dalliance, very complicated, but a dalliance. And then there's the point of view, as we've already said, that if you keep getting this mathematics that works, it's probably leading you to some fundamental truth about how the universe actually operates.
Yeah, well, again, being ultra-conservative, yeah, with a small c on this, probably, perhaps not the right word, but close, I would say it's still the best bet we have, mm-hmm. right? I mean, yesterday we were in a talk with Edward Witten on this, and he's extremely cautious. He's not somebody to go high-kicking yeah. in saying, you know, I'm right, everybody else is wrong. He said, this is the best way, this is our best bet for building on those theories of gravity and for gauge. He's not a fool by any means, and nor are the other dozens of experts, right? I find it, I really think it important to try to explain why they have this faith in the way that, I ought to say that if experimental clues came up, they are pretty confident they'd drop everything, right?
Of course,
and follow
right,
them. That's right. Of course true, right? But for the moment, that the fact that this string framework holds together so well, it certainly has got problems. There's absolutely no doubt about that, right? But theories have had problems before. I mean, you could go back to Newton's theory of gravity, where people just did not take that seriously on the continent for decades. You go look at Dirac's theory of holes back in 1930, which people thought, well, the Dirac equation, you know, there's something severely wrong with this. This appalling problem of, you know, these infinite seas of particles and everything, these went away when we developed our understanding. And I think there is a reasonable hope that through developing the mathematics, it'd be wonderful to have experimental clues, that we will advance in an orderly way. But it does require patience. That is true. That's what I think we're short of in physics at the moment.
Short of patience?
Yeah. Remember, you know, when again, it's a coincidence, but when I moved into this field, it was like a party. It was seriously, Steve, it was like a party. It seemed to me that every other month, experimenters were coming up with really exciting discoveries. I remember my supervisor, when they were talking about the so-called tau lepton, which is a distant cousin of the electron. And I remember him saying, oh, well, this will go away. And the experimenters were going, and it became a real particle, right? Now, that's one of dozens of examples here. It was really exciting, not just to see what the experimenters were doing, but to see the working cheek by jowl with theorists, and they were building up what we now call the standard model of the forces that shape the structure of atoms. It was an incredibly exciting time. They were coming year after year after year, but that did dry up. It was a flood, and it went down to a trickle. Now, what do we do? Throw up our hands and do nothing, or do we take a reasonable route, always building on, this is a crucial point, the two fundamental theories of 20th century theoretical physics, which are the special theory of relativity, which is a theory of motion pioneered by several people, in particular Albert Einstein, and quantum mechanics discovered by Heisenberg and Schrödinger, later Dirac and others came in. Those theories have never been undermined experimentally. No one has ever cast doubt on those. Now, by sticking with those two guide rails, right, insisting that your fundamental theories stick with those theories, has been a very, very fruitful way of developing stuff. And that is something that happened in quantum field theory, where you build on that. I ought to stress, it's very difficult to do. This is extremely important, right? To get those, Einstein, for example, thought it's just not going to be possible to combine those theories, right? Dirac is another one, and others thought this is just too difficult, right? But it's turned out that you really can build a quantum theory of the subatomic forces, subnuclear forces, that respect those two theories. And by insisting on those things, it's extremely difficult to walk those two tightropes at the same time. You can be kept on the rails, so to speak, and know that you're traced back to real hard experimental facts. Now, where it's leading to some wild places, all these weird and wonderful topographical discoveries that people are making within the context of string theory and what have you. But nonetheless, it's rooted in that stuff. Now, it may be we've taken wrong turnings. Of course, that may be true. But still, I would argue, I believe, in the way that many leading theorists argue, that this is the best chance we have of making advances in the current climate.
The current climate includes the fact that we are only capable of reaching the extreme conditions.
Yep.
We're only capable of reaching some of the close, the low-hanging fruit of extreme conditions
that would reveal some of these things experimentally.
Yep.
And, you know, as you say in the book, we'd need a particle accelerator the size of the whole planet to do some of the experiments that would bear things out. So when you say patience, are you talking about, you know, 300 years or 20 years?
Well, first of all, let me just say that the string framework that you referred to there, that most naturally lives at extremely high energies. And that's going to means that to test it directly is going to be a real challenge. Now, that's not to say that you can't have predictions that show up at lower energies that are a consequence of that framework. Now, that's where people just write this off. But things can happen like that. And that is what people are looking at very, very hard. Now, it is definitely true that it's going to be a longer haul than we had hoped in those golden times when nature was just giving us one clue after another. And it has been, it's true to say, for most people, a disappointment that the Large Hadron Collider, which is a phenomenal achievement of experimenters and engineers and all the other people that have made that happen, right, that we've been given this wonderful confirmation of the Higgs particle, the last missing piece in the Standard Model, but really nothing else that is a real surprise. Right now, that is undoubtedly a disappointment, and it's a surprise that contrary to our expectations based on lower energies, that those things haven't shown up, right? So I admit it does require patience with funding, and indeed the theoreticians as a whole will have to hang in there. And I agree that does require some trust on the part of the community around us. Where I part company with the critics is that I don't think things are anything like as gloomy as they say. I would say this as well. If I may say, I personally wish more leading theorists would explain directly their case. At the moment, they don't. Right? They just don't want to get involved in that because that's not what they're particularly good at. Be involved in these punch-ups, so to speak. Right? And I wish that were not the case because at the moment there's a very loud echo chamber of dissidents. I'm sure very good people, but that, in my view, they have a disproportionate influence on the climate of thinking among scientists. It's very common now to hear really smart people say, "Well, string theory, that's a dead end," and what have you. I just don't think that's just not the view of many of the world's experts. I say again, ultimately nature will be the judge. I believe we should be respectful of the highest or the high achieving people in physics, but I accept always be skeptical, but give them a fair hearing. That's the key point.
One of the fascinating things you talk about in the book, that's been going on for about the last 30 years, how many different approaches that seem to be only just distantly related or maybe not related at all wind up leading you to the same place. So people are realizing that they're actually approaching the problem from completely different directions and winding up with the same solutions. And so you have, string theories. This is the M theory business, I think. Where different string theories turn out to be equivalent, and different aspects of string theory turn out to be equivalent. And then the gauge theories or the different aspects of them turn out to be. And then you have the fellow, I forgot his name.
Madelsena.
Who realizes that one of the string theories and one of the gauge theory approaches is absolutely
exactly
equivalent.
Yeah, it is straight. But we're talking here about dualities, and this is one of the big puzzles, right? You're absolutely right. Throughout theoretical physics, not just particle physics, but condensed matter physics, the physics of solids and field theories in general, that one of the really big things of the 90s were these repeated discoveries of these dualities, right, where you have two mathematical frameworks that look quite different, but give exactly the same predictions about nature. And this year is a dual to each other. Now, I must say, this isn't a completely new phenomenon, right? This, you can trace this back to Maxwell's time, back in the 19th century, right, where there was seen as a duality in that theory of electricity and magnetism, which was particularly highlighted by Oliver Heaviside. Now we really are.
But in quantum mechanics, Schrodinger and Heisenberg have completely different approaches.
In a sense. But now they are all over the place. Yeah. So people are saying now there's something we're we're really not getting at the bottom of this. And Nadi Saibou, the eminent field theorist, say we are missing something deep here. Right now, this is a very important point. Notice here that these theorists are not saying we're doing great, we're really brilliant here, everything's working out. They're not saying that. They're saying we really are missing something fundamental here, right? With something that we need a new approach to this subject. The biggest surprise of all was, as you say, the Maldacena discovery that a particular string theory, right, can give exactly the same answers as a particular gauge theory. There are lots of riders on that, but that was seen as almost, as you try to express, a kind of miracle, right? Now, it's also important, right, as the people who live in the real world say, that's not a real field theory, that's not a real string. That is true, right? But in the bones of theory, I think this really has got something to do with the real world. That does require faith. I completely accept that. They know that. These people are incredibly smart people. Yeah. They know that, right? But that's why people think that really could lead to a completely new understanding of gravity, right? That is what this thing promises, and that's why that duality is used so often in exploring black holes, which, as Douglas Stanford, a leading theorist, once said, is the ground zero of the war between quantum mechanics and the theory of gravity, right? Mm-hmm. Which are very difficult to combine. And when you actually look at that combination very closely, black holes is a great laboratory to study that on. And those dual theories allow you to make calculations and study it in detail.
So let me ask you, from my limited educational understanding, let me draw an analogy to, you know, if light is a wave or a particle. Mm. So some experiments make it look like it's a wave and some make it look like it's a particle. Yep. In reality, I don't know what it is. Yep. Nobody knows what it is. Mm-hmm. But the math we use and the experiments that we do point to one or the other, and they're both approximations of some deeper underlying reality.
Yep.
So on a very simplistic basis, is that what we're dealing with here? We're dealing with some still unknown, maybe unknowable underlying reality, and with our limited human brains and the inventions that we can come up with, we keep approximating it from, you know, it's like the old story about the blind people feeling the elephant and trying to describe what it is and figure out what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But that goes against the idea that the mathematics itself, the coherency of the mathematics does indeed point to the deeper reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if I've asked a question.
No. Well, first of all, you're right about that. This idea that light, some people say, is described in some circumstances as a wave, other times as a particle. But when you have a really deep understanding of light through something called quantum electrodynamics, you can understand that in the framework of a single theory. What we have in these modern versions of field theory, modern quantum field theories, it keeps happening that we get these pairings of things that suggest that this has got to be more than a coincidence, surely. Right, and this is what leads so many people to think that we really don't have a basic understanding of those theories. Now, there's another thing, incidentally, that comes up here, which is that when you do really simple calculations, which we have to do to understand the experiments at the Large Hadron Collider, and you do the collisions between, for example, gluons, these particles that mediate the strong force inside nuclei, when those things collide, when quarks collide, the standard, well-respected, well-tested theory gives calculations that are hundreds and hundreds of pages long and then distilled down, right, into a few lines. Something weird is going on. Even Feynman said this. I happen to know because people that spoke to him. We're not calculating them in the same way. That is another clue, so to speak, that we're missing something big. So, but you see here, we're taking a clue from mathematics, because mathematically these things look different. They get the same answers. We're somehow taking our clues not directly from the experiments, but from our mathematical perception of the theories. So, as I said, you can see. I hope I'm giving a sense of by exploring these series, we know we don't understand them fully, and there's more to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so many different science fields. When a framework is put together, I'm thinking of Mendeleev and the periodic table, and Einstein, Darwin, and evolution. You know, you put the framework together, and then a hole is in the framework somewhere. Not a hole like Dirac would theorize about, but you know, Mendeleev said there should be an element here. We're going to find it. And Darwin's theory says there's going to be a moth with a very long tongue because there's something that has
or
nectar
something in the fossil
it.
Record. Or
exactly.
Something like that.
We're going to find something if we look for it. It actually is. It gives you a research program. And so it seems in some way like we're talking about that as well, that this is pointing to stuff. The problem is it's not so easy to look for.
No, I know. And this is undoubtedly, absolutely undoubtedly a challenge for people interested in the way that, you know, the way the atoms work, so to speak. And as I say, this is a difficult, this is definitely a challenging period. There's absolutely no doubt about that. My view is that that there are sufficiently many positive clues that that there's no reason to be despondent. But I do accept that the lack of clean experimental tests, the way that the expectations of the theorists for what we would see at the Large Hadron Collider were not realized. So it does make you vulnerable to critics who say, well, these guys have lost their way. What I think is very important is that the critics, you know, I'm sure have complete integrity in this. They aren't suggesting better ways ahead. That really is right. Or if they are, that they are, how can I put it? Most of very quickly dispense with, frankly, right? Even though they might survive in the popular sphere, right? Because you know in physics, if you come up with a really good idea, right, that is counter-orthodox, so to speak, people will jump on it pretty quickly in the positive direction if they think it's going to further their careers. And I happen to believe that the science community, the theoretical physics community in particular, if there were a better way, they would move to it pretty quickly. Right. And I don't think the critics, and I, as I said, I respect their integrity in doing that and their honesty in coming out with it. But we're not getting from them the other options that we can pursue.
One of the things that you talk about that's so kind of wonderful about math is things have been developed by mathematicians decades or even more than century.
Yeah.
You talk toward the end of the book, I forget the mathematician's name, but he did work in the late 19th century that people suddenly realized was applicable.
This is Grassmann?
I think so.
Yeah, well, there's several of them
like
that.
Yeah,
the best example is the one has suddenly been found to be useful is Einstein's search for his theory of gravity. He believed, as a young researcher, that you didn't need advanced mathematics to do research, and he did brilliantly in that. He came out with his theory of the light quanta, his Brownian motion, his relativity, and the mathematics there was quite simple. It was well over 100 years old, and he flourished brilliantly on that.
Yeah, the mathematics. I remember taking what was then called modern physics. And the mathematics is really straightforward.
It's pretty straightforward. Yeah. Anyway.
As opposed to general relativity.
Let's come on to that. When he wanted to develop his theory of relativity and generalize it in such a way that it would give him a theory of gravity, he found around 1912, courtesy of his old friend Besso, that he couldn't do that unless he used this advanced mathematics of differential geometry, of tensors and what have you. Now, as a student, Einstein had skipped his math classes. He just ignored all this stuff, and he really found he had to use it, right? And what made such a searing impact on him was that mathematics, in his perception, it led him to that answer in large measure. People say rightly that he underplayed the extent to which experimental constraints guide him to that answer. That's true, but for him, it was a very, very powerful time, right? When it was mathematics guided him to a new law of nature, to a successor for Isaac of Newton's theory of gravity. And I might say straight away, differential geometry was super turbocharged by that work of Einstein's, and suddenly became a much more flourishing aspect of mathematics. I mean, the ideal world, because we don't live in an ideal world. We have to deal with nature as we find it, right? It was wonderful, as in my youth and all my friends and colleagues there, when nature was just talking to you through these experiments all the time, right? But it's not happening now. So it seems to me that we have to take advantage of what mathematics is telling us. And so far, it seems that it's telling us a lot of mind-blowing things that unfortunately are not, most of them not amenable to, directly to experiment, but that doesn't mean that they're wrong, right? It means that we have to develop them carefully and spend time getting the picture right.
You talked about Feynman. It's a great quote in your book. He was making fun of a string theorist.
Oh yeah,
at Caltech,
mm-hmm.
And he saw him walking down the hall, and he shouted out at him. Do you remember the quote?
Yeah, he said, "How many dimensions are you in today, John
Schwartz?"
John Schwartz, right. Yeah, he was a great one of the great pioneers of string theory. Now, to be fair, Richard Feynman, an absolutely brilliant theorist, was skeptical. I think it's fair to say, but it is true that he did say some harsh things about the string framework, and he certainly never studied in great detail, as far as I know. But he was, according to John Schwartz, being largely jocular. It's important to put up history there, because Murray Gell-Mann, who was his sometimes friendly rival at Caltech, he really did nurture John Schwartz at Caltech when that was a very unpopular field. And John and Michael Green from the University of London, they did, after a long period of working together, come up with that string framework, which has proved very rich for exploration for physicists, not in direct contact with experiment, that's perfectly true. But the thing that is really encouraging to them is that it's been a Klondike for mathematicians. Mm-hmm. I mean, I spoke several times with Sir Michael Atiyah, one of the great mathematicians of the 20th century.
He just died in January.
I interviewed him for my own podcast just a few weeks before he died. Oh. And although he never worked directly on string theory, he was saying that was just like the biggest Christmas present we ever had in mathematics, because of the number of ideas it generated. And again, In the spirit of Dirac, you could say there's a sign there. Mm-hmm. But that does require faith. It's not proof, but it's a sign that when researchers in physics and mathematics are on the same territory, right, or in this, just trading zones, so to speak, overlapping trading zones, that something is going right. I stress again, it's a matter of faith, but I think it's worth persevering with.
What do you hope that lay people who are just sort of generally interested in math and science will get from your book?
I hope that they will see this as a great intellectual adventure that began, roughly speaking, with Newton. You could say it was before, but I begin with Newton, and it continues to this day. These are, as we've discussed, lean times in terms of the standard way of doing science. But I think they're very exciting, because I think that if theorists are right, and that they are being that things are going in a good direction with the string framework and our understanding of field theory, we really have the prospect of a radically new understanding of space and time, and we can really address really big questions of how the universe began, how it might end, and what have you. These are really fundamental questions that we can only answer by digging very, very deep into an understanding of the laws of nature.
That's it for this episode. Get your science news at our website, www.scientificamerican.com, where you can read the article in the new issue of Scientific American, the October issue, by Ellen Ripple-Shell, A New Theory of Obesity. It examines the role of ultra-processed foods in the obesity epidemic. And follow us on Twitter, where you'll get a tweet whenever a new item hits the website. Our Twitter name is @SciAm. For Scientific American Science Talk, I'm Steve Mirsky. Thanks for clicking on us.